We're doing an introduction to halacha today. When we discuss halacha, so we're used to thinking of the bottom line. What do I do? What do I do when I wake up in the morning? How should I wash my hands? How do I make the blessing? Do I make a blessing on mizonos first or shahakol first? So we're going to learn that when you're going to drink something and eat something, so mizonos, you make the blessing of mizonos before you make the blessing of shahakol on a drink. It's true, halacha is the bottom line, but how do we get there? So we're going to take a journey to discover the sources of halacha and how we get to the bottom line of halacha. And we have to discern between two things. One is the true source of halacha, which is what we are going to try to understand today. And two is how do we practically apply all of this? Because in order to attain halacha the way one should, one has to work from the sources the way we will describe. And here at the Machon, we are very limited in time, and therefore we have to get to the bottom line. So we have to compromise to an extent. So we're going to work on two fronts. The first front is to first understand the breakdown of how we attain halacha. And then we'll understand how we at the Machon practically have to learn halacha, which are two different things. Moshe Benu is told at Sinai, come up, God says, come up, I want to give you the Torah. And when God calls Moshe up to Sinai, God tells him, come up the mountain, Ve'etna lecha, I will give to you luchot ha'even, the luchos, Va'torah, and the Torah, Va'mitzvah, and the mitzvah, the Mishnah, the oral law, Asher katavti, the prophets, the writings, Le'orotam, the Gemara, come up to Sinai, you're getting everything. So we have a tradition, the Gemara says, that when Moshe went up to Sinai, God gave him the written law, together with the written law, God gave him the oral law, Mishnah and Gemara. Mishnah and Gemara starts from Moshe Rabbeinu. When Moshe was given the Torah, he was given it with the oral law, with the Mishnah and the Gemara. So he goes up to Sinai, and God starts teaching him the Torah. So he has the best Rebbe in the world. God's teaching him. And yet, the way God teaches him is over 40 days and 40 nights. It's not in a flash, right? God could have just put a new chip, a new disk in his hard drive. And now he knows everything. It's not how it works. Not only did God teach him slowly, it seems. Slowly. I mean, he covered the whole Torah in 40 days and 40 nights. It wasn't so slowly. But not only did God teach him the Torah, but God gave him pauses in between each parsha. That's why we have a break between the parshiyos, to remind us how Moshe Rabbeinu had a pause in between parshiyos to reflect. And that reflection is important. And at one point, God told Moshe, these are the laws, and now I'm going to give you the laws of logic from which you will infer the other laws. And we have 13 laws of logic, which we say sometimes if we make it, if we have enough time in the morning prayer, there are 13 laws, principles of logic, with which we could derive new laws. One example of the laws of logic is a fortiori, a kavachomer, which basically says, if Max is 10 times as strong as I am, so if I could lift this cup, definitely Max could lift this cup, right? That's a law of logic. It's called a fortiori. Another law of logic is a law of inference, that we say if a term is used, the word yikah is used in the Torah to describe a sale that involves money, so then when in our parsha the Torah describes a man marrying a woman and it uses the word yikah, ki yikah ishisha, when a man marries a woman, that's coming to teach us that deal of her marriage to him can happen through money. That deal, she can get married to him through money. How do we know that? Because in other places in the Torah, we find that the term yikah describes a transaction that involves money. So he's not buying her, she's not his slave, the wife, but that agreement that she will be his wife, we can finalize that agreement with money. Because we find that the word yikah involves money. Now, that type of derivation is called the gzirat shava. If we derive it shaveh, you have the same word, and we say if this word has these connotations here, it will also have these connotations there. Now, obviously, if you use that, then you could abolish the whole Torah, because you just say, look, the word eh, the word the, right, it's used in every sentence, over here it means this, over there it means that, let's do a mishmash. So we have a tradition that you could only apply Gzirat Shavah when we have a tradition which words should be used. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that the tradition included where you take those words from. Sometimes that is tradition, you learn these two words, somewhere in the Torah you'll find these two words, learn from them, and then our sages had discussions. Are they these two words over here or these two words over there? Where do we derive it from? But there was a tradition from which you used the Gzirat Shavah. You couldn't just take any two words in Tanakh and say, oh, this is what it means here, this is what it means there, let's do mishmash, and now we could ruin everything. So Moshe Rabbeinu was taught the 13 laws of logic. Next step, God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, now use the logic and derive a new law. And God gives Moshe Rabbeinu a new case, tells him, in the following case I want you to think it through and prove what the law is. Moshe Rabbeinu starts thinking, thinks of one logical proof that it should be permissible, another logical proof should be permissible. He comes back to God, he says, God, I came up with 49 proofs that in this case should be permissible. And I came up with 49 logical proofs that in this case it should be forbidden. What do I do now? God said, very good. That's what I wanted. 49, you should see that logically you could prove in 49 ways, in any specific case, that it should be permissible, that it should be forbidden. So Moshe says, no, what good is it? I got the laws of logic, but I'm going to have one rabbi saying this way, another rabbi saying that way, and they're both logically correct. So God tells Moshe, the way it's going to work is you're going to put together a Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is the Latin word for wise men. And God tells Moshe, put together a Sanhedrin, the Greek word for wise men. What's the point of the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin is a group of sages who thought and learned Torah and got the Jewish tradition and purified themselves. What do I mean by purified themselves? Every person has things that affect him. We discussed Wednesday night that some philosophers say man created God in his form. And to an extent, we do try to apply what we think to God. I always tell guys the story about the small shtetl in Europe that ordered a Sefer Torah, and half a year before the Sefer Torah is finished to be written, so the rabbi gathers in all the women and he tells them, look, in a half a year we'll have Sefer Torah brought into the shul, we're going to have great celebration, we're inviting people from the nearby towns, and the woman who makes the nicest cover for the Sefer Torah, we're going to use that cover to bring the Sefer Torah in. And this way all the women prepared a cover for the Sefer Torah, they'd have spare, and every woman will try to make theirs the nicest. So they set up a panel of judges, and all the women start preparing. Each one tries to get the best material, the nicest ornaments, and they're preparing a nice cover for the Sefer Torah. They're given a deadline 2 months before the Sefer Torah is to be brought in. The judges will decide which is the nicest cover. So the date comes, and all the women excitedly bring in their cover for the Sefer Torah, and the panel of judges looks over the covers, and they think about it, they discuss it, they deliberate, and they decide that number one prize goes to Mrs. Schwartz. Number two is Mrs. Frankfurter. So they call her Mrs. Schwartz, and they tell her, look, you get the honor. 2 months from now, this is the date. We're bringing in the Sefer Torah. You can invite all your relatives. In 2 months, we are bringing the Sefer Torah in, and we'll use your cover. So Mrs. Schwartz starts writing out letters and telegrams and telling all her neighbors and friends and relatives and all the towns far out, you have to come see the beautiful cover I made. We're bringing the Sefer Torah in 2 months. Come honor the Torah and come join our rejoicing of the bringing the Sefer Torah in. That great day comes. Mrs. Schwartz can't sleep the night before. The next day everyone's going to see that beautiful Sefer Torah. She worked so hard to make the cover. Finally, the great day comes, she's all jittery, they come in, the scribe writes the last letters of the Sefer Torah. They want to bring the Sefer Torah outside to rejoice with it. They take the cover that she made, they put it on the Sefer Torah, and it's a half a foot short. She mismeasured. They gave her the measurement, and she was so excited, she made it too short. So she's standing there, she's horrified. All her friends, all her neighbors, everyone's coming to see the cover she made. So they look and they say, okay, look, Mrs. Frankfurter was number two, so we'll have to use her cover. And Mrs. Schwartz says, no, 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 no. why can't you use my cover? So they tell her, but it's too short. You can't use that cover. So she says, look, I'll tell you what you do. Cut a little bit from the scroll on top and a little bit from the scroll on bottom, and then it'll fit just right. So, in truth, we're all that way. We all have what we think, and when we approach the Torah, we try to cut a little bit on top and cut a little bit on bottom and make it fit what we think. And when God came to give the Torah to the Jewish people, so we have a tradition that He sent a prophet to each nation. And each nation was offered, do you want to receive the Torah? God has the book that will guide you how to live in this world the best possible way. Do you want to receive it? And each nation asked, what's written in it? So the people of Esau asked God, what's written in it? And God said, oh, it says you cannot murder. And they said, what do you mean? Part of our job is we're hunters. And if people get in our way, we murder too. We can't do that. God went to the people of Ishmael. He said, do you want to receive my Torah? They said, what's written in it? He said, you have to be moral. You can't intermarry. You can't steal. He said, we can't do that. That's part of our livelihood. That's how we live life. Each nation had something that God asked, what's in it? And God told them something that was against their nature. And they said, we can't have this. And then God came to the Jewish people and said, do you want to accept my Torah? And the Jews said, yeah, whatever you say we'll do. Afterwards, tell us what's written in it. But yeah, we accept. What was the difference between the Jews and other nations? But God, it seems, was unfair to the other nations. He told them that mitzvah which goes against their grain. When guys come to Machon, I always tell them, first do the things that work for you. Slowly you build and you understand that the other things also you have to do. But a person has to build slowly. You suddenly tell a person, you have to change your whole lifestyle. Do everything different than what you're used to. So that's difficult. Sometimes a person can't handle that. You work slowly. You build a person. Why is God coming and telling these nations, bam, the thing that goes exactly against their grain? So Rabbi Katz, who by the way has 1,000 free shiurim on the web, 613.org, I think you could access them, beautiful shiurim. So he explains that the nations, God came and said, I have a Torah. And they said, God, what's written in it? When you say what's written in it, you're basically saying, God, I know you're God, you created the world, you know what's the best way to live in this world. But it has to get my stamp of approval. I want to hear what's written in it. The second they said that, God said, you can't accept the Torah. Part of accepting the Torah is understanding. God gave the Torah. He made the world. He knows what's the right way to live in this world. He knows what's eternally good and what's not. So the Jews said, God, whatever you say, we'll do. We want to understand. Teach us. But whatever you say, we'll do. That's how you have to approach the Torah. The Torah has to tell us what's right and what's wrong, and then we'll do it. The second you come with your own understanding and say, okay, God, tell me, I'll see if it makes sense to me. Basically, you're saying, I'll do what makes sense to me. So then you're running the show, not God. You guys with me? Heads are drooping. Okay.
Where's the pocket?
So the people who are going to be on the Sanhedrin are people who have to know themselves and know what their personal, what we say in Hebrew, are negi'ut, where they themselves have personal inclinations and have to overcome them. A rabbi can't approach a halachic question and say, the conclusion can't be this. I'm not going to be able to live with this. And when you approach a question, you have to approach it with such pure logic that nothing of your own feelings and your own philosophies affected. A person has to be totally open to let the Torah tell him what's right. And if a person isn't, then he can't give a halachic ruling. I had last night, a guy came to me and asked me a question, dating a girl seriously, and after we ended here, so a guy came knocking on my door at 12:30 last night, or 1 o'clock, and he was considering getting engaged to a girl, and he had a certain question. So he sat there and spoke, and after a half hour I told him, I don't think I could help you, because we have very different personalities, and if I'm going to give you advice, I have to put myself in your shoes. And we're so different personality-wise that I can't put myself in your shoes. I don't think I could think clearly, certainly not 1 o'clock at night, think clearly what's right for you. I could tell you what I would do in your situation, but who says that's right for you? I can't. I have to think what's right for you in your situation, considering who you are. I don't know. I can't do that right now. I can't think for you. When you answer a question, a person has to take himself out of the picture completely, totally. The answer has to be completely what's written in the Torah. What is the Torah telling me is right here? Now that's very difficult. If you think about it, almost everything we do and every opinion we have has some tainted coloring of who we are, not the truth. Even when we approach logic, we come with our own presuppositions. The conclusion can't be X, can't be Y. We think that we know what's right, and it's very hard to overcome that. We have logic. God gave us logic. That's true. But if we're going to learn the Torah and give halachic ruling, we have to purify ourselves from what we think and be open to accepting what the Torah thinks. That's very difficult. But that's step number one for someone to be a rabbi and give halachic ruling. Why is that so important? Because of step number two. Hashem shows Moshe that logically you can prove in 49 ways from the laws that are written in the Torah on any given question that the ruling is going to be positive or negative, permissible or forbidden. So logic could prove both ways. You have enough sources in the Torah to derive a logical proof that something should be permitted or something should be forbidden. So how are you going to decide what the right answer is? So God says, get the rabbis, teach them these laws of logic, have them learn the Torah and purify themselves. And then, after a person is pure, and he is using pure logic, not his own intuition or what he feels, but pure logic, I installed in human beings the human factor. And the human factor is that if we sit together and analyze the same question, there's going to be one angle which is going to seem more logical to me than it will to you. Not because of who I am and where I've grown up and what my presuppositions are, but because of my logic being different than your logic. Every person was blessed with his own intellect, and part of that intellect is the potential to analyze things logically and purely and reach his own conclusion. And that conclusion is going to be logical, not because that I grew up in an area where these types of people were terrible and I think the halachic ruling should be against them, or I grew up in an area where these types of people were amazing and I want the halachic ruling to be for them. Nothing to do with who I am, where I grew up, and what my attitude to life is, but because of my pure logic. So God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, installed in the Torah, how do you derive halachic ruling? Part of the derivation is predicated upon having rabbis who purify themselves, know the laws of logic very, very well, and then will come to different conclusions. And then you sit in the Sanhedrin and you take all the conclusions and you add them up. Say, how many people say this should be permitted? How many people say this should be forbidden? And the majority wins. Here we see some source for democracy in Judaism. We'll discuss other sources a different time. God says, "Acharei rabim nato." You decide based upon the majority, but that majority has to be people who are working based on pure logic. You guys with me till here?
Is it a simple majority or is it...
Simple majority. There are going to be times when it's not a simple majority, but in general it's a simple majority. No, the rabbis sit together and each one explains to the other one why he's saying what he's saying. They try to convince one another. Each one has to hear the other one out. And then when they've all heard one another out, each one has their conclusion, and then we reach a final conclusion. So Moshe is given the Torah. He teaches the Torah to the Jewish people. Moshe is given the laws of inference, the laws of logic. He teaches that to the Jewish people. Moshe puts together his Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin has the power to rule, to decide on new questions that arise, deriving with the laws of logic from the Torah. The Sanhedrin has the power to enact rabbinic decrees and rabbinic laws. Part of the job of the Sanhedrin is to help us distance ourselves from transgressing. For example, on Shabbos, we're not allowed to write. So, our sages instituted a rabbinic decree that one shouldn't even touch a pencil. You walk around with a pencil in your pocket, you have a pencil with you, you're going to end up writing. So our sages instituted the concept of muktzeh. Things that we say, don't even touch them. If you can't use it on Shabbos, you're not even allowed to touch it. That's a rabbinic decree. That's to help us not transgress. People are going to walk around with everything they're not allowed to do, they'll end up doing things that they're not allowed to do if they carry objects that they shouldn't be using on Shabbos. You guys with me until now? So even on rabbinic decrees, again, the rabbis have to sit together and decide, does it make sense to institute this rabbinic decree or not? So we have Doraisa, biblical laws. We have Drabanan, rabbinic decrees, rabbinic institutions. Sages instituted, before you eat, wash your hands. Don't eat with your hands filthy. Moshe is given the written law. Moshe is given the oral law. Moshe teaches the Jewish people and establishes a Sanhedrin. We have other courts, not only the Sanhedrin, we have lower courts. The highest court is the Sanhedrin. What? What do people want? Okay. So we have Moshe's generation. And then the Torah continues that way for a few generations. The Torah is given to the people and they have to decide what the law is. When Moshe is about to pass away, so he asks Yeshua, is there anything you don't remember? Is there anything you want to review? And Yeshua says, I think I got it all down pat. Moshe passes away, and then the Jews mourn him for 30 days. After those 30 days, they start reviewing the Torah, and they find that they've forgotten 3,000 halachos. 3,000 halachos they forgot. They're about to enter the land of Israel, and they discover they have 3,000 halachos. They don't know what to do. So Yeshua turns to God, and he says, God, help me out. What do we do with these 3,000 halachos? And God tells him, Moshe Avdi Met. Moshe, my servant, he passed away. The only one who got the Torah from the heavens is Moshe. From now on, you guys have to figure it out on your own. Sit down with the Sanhedrin, use the laws of logic, and infer. And the Rambam says that if a prophet will walk into a Sanhedrin and say, God sent me to tell you that the halachic ruling in this case that you're contemplating now is X, we tell him, you know, that's forbidden. You're going to be put to death. God doesn't send word from heaven to tell us what the halachic ruling is. Ever since Moshe passed away, the Torah is in our hands, and the Sanhedrin's job to derive what the halach is. A prophet is considered false. We say God wouldn't send a prophet to tell us what the halachic ruling is, because God gave it into the hands of the Sanhedrin. Yeah?
I hear about that there was the Sanhedrin re-established.
So that we'll get to.
There is a group of rabbis which call themselves Sanhedrin. My question is now, how far are they accepted and how far...
Wait, we didn't understand yet what a Sanhedrin is. Wait, give us time. We're still holding about 3,000, over 3,000 years ago, almost 4,000 years ago. So we'll get to today. We have a way to go. Yeah.
Let's just say, like, this can't take argument. Would this ever happen? I hope not. Just for the sake of argument, I got the whole Sanhedrin. They read a certain Torah verse or something, and somehow they totally misunderstand it. And they said laws of logic don't work. And so, let's just say the prophet comes along and says, God says it is wrong because the prophet, because the logic is such and such, and the verse doesn't fit. What if he had had logic? I guess God told him the logic to be had some sort of logic to back him up, and it refuted.
I don't know. But the Rambam says that we wouldn't accept a prophet walking in and saying, God sent me to give you a halachic ruling. You're saying, what if he says, God gave me this form of logic, so why does he have to say it in the form of prophecy? He should convince them with the logic. As a prophet, he shouldn't use his strength as a prophet to give a halachic ruling.
He can't do his prophecy alone, but I suppose God could prophecy to him what the correct logic is.
Yeah, but then he shouldn't tell them God said so. He should just say, here's the logic.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've got the Torah and you've got the rabbinic decree. Now, can the Sanhedrin either sit in the rabbinic decree that is magnitude?
Good question. Let's get to that in a second. Remind me, please, if I don't address it, to address it, okay? The Sanhedrin, on the one hand, is given Siyata Dishmaya. We say God gives them special help. There was a book compiled in the 12th century, Responsa, that one of the rabbis compiled when no one asked him a question. He'd invent the questions, and then he'd write the answers. And this was his way of writing Responsa. I guess he didn't have a crowd that had too many questions, so he wanted to compile a very important book, which is important and brought halachically, but he wrote the questions. So some of the rabbis didn't like his sefer because they said God gives special guidance to a rabbi to answer a question correctly when someone asks him a question. When no one really asks you the question, you don't have that special divine help to get the right answer. And the same thing is true for the Sanhedrin. You said the Sanhedrin has divine assistance to get it right. That doesn't mean they can't err. They could err. The Sanhedrin, there are special laws in the Torah. What happens if the Sanhedrin rule one way and then they recognize, hey, we made a mistake? So that could happen. We don't say that they're infallible. We say that we have to listen to them. The Torah says you have to listen to them. Now, Sanhedrin gives a ruling. Sanhedrin gives a ruling on a new case. It says that when King David went out to fight Goliath, he wasn't king yet. Saul was king. So he sees David going out to fight him and win it. So Saul asks his assistants, who is that kid? Now we know historically that David was in front of Saul before the story for quite a period of time playing the harp before him. Saul knew him and loved him. So what's King Saul asking his assistant, who is that kid? He knows him. This is the guy that's in front of him every day playing the harp. This is his main assistant. So our sages say that King Saul asked, is that kid fit to be king? Is he my competition? So one of his assistants, one of his advisors said, what, before you ask me if he could be king, ask me if he could marry into the Jewish people. His grandmother was Ruth, the Moabite. Who says he's even allowed to marry a Jew? And the other assistant said, what do you mean? The Torah says in our parsha that a male Moabite may not marry into the Jewish people. His grandmother was a female Moabite, and therefore he's kosher. He could marry into the Jewish people, and he's fit. So they were arguing. And King Saul said to them, oh, so one rabbi is saying this way, another rabbi is saying that way. Go to the high court, go to the Sanhedrin, and ask them what the ruling is. And here we have an insight as to how simple, to an extent, halacha used to be, that when there was a doubt between the rabbis, they could always go to the high court, and the high court would rule. Today we don't have that. So, during the time of the first temple, we had a Sanhedrin. During the time of the second temple, we had a Sanhedrin. And then, after the second temple, we stopped having a Sanhedrin. So, when a halachic question arises, we no longer have the ability to use the 13 principles because we no longer have that tradition. We know that there was a great sage, Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan had 5 disciples. One of them was Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. I think that we should stop now. Even though I wanted to go till 10:30, I get the feeling that everyone's finished. So I think we're going to start again our introduction next week with Rabbi Yochanan. I just get the feeling that everyone here is not with it. So one person's with it. But I think we're going to stop.